Our sun is headed into solar maximum, the period of greatest activity in its solar cycle. My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to the new podcast series called Space Weather Living History. During this series, you'll hear directly from the people who for years have been studying the evolution of space weather, how we make observations, and our capabilities to predict space weather events. Now, every 11 years on average, our sun reaches a peak period of activity called solar maximum. That's followed a few years later by a period of quiet called solar minimum. During solar maximum, there are many sunspots, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, all of which can affect communications and technology here on Earth. Now, the energy from those solar blasts can disrupt radio communications, upset electrical power systems, damage satellites and change their orbits, cause navigational equipment to make mistakes, and even endanger astronauts walking in space. The effects from these solar storms can be far-reaching. In fact, they can have impacts throughout our entire solar system. These conditions are what we refer to as space weather. Sound exciting? Let's get right to the next interview.
Okay, my name is Joan Feynman. I work at the Jet Propulsion Lab at this time. And space weather is something I do from time to time. But solar-terrestrial relationships is what I do all the time. Space weather is a subset of those because it consists of the sun doing something to the solar wind that does something to the Earth. And it becomes space weather when it's dangerous to something else, like people or power plants. Well, it's really the effect of the sun on the Earth. Mostly, and on the interplanetary medium between the sun and the Earth. And it's not just the effects of the sun, it's also understanding the sun itself. There are lots of problems about the sun. For instance, how does it get its solar cycle? And why is the solar wind the way it is, and so on. And so I cover all of those problems. But some years ago, when I first came to JPL, which must be already 30 years now, I was in a group where my boss asked me to make a model for the environment that the Magellan satellite could be expecting as it flew. And I looked at what had been done, and I thought the person who had done it had done a very good start at devising a method, but that there were certain things that needed improvement. So I improved them. One of the things was that it had been considered that each solar energy particle event was independent of another. And if you looked at the data, that wasn't true. They came in groups. And if you do a statistical analysis, which is what I was doing, you have to take account that there are groups, not just individual ones. And that was my major contribution to that for quite a while. There are still arguments about what are the groups. I think it's known. But not everybody agrees. Yeah, when there's the most important thing in space weather, I would say, is that there are events when in the solar wind there are high energy particles accelerated by disturbances in the solar wind. These disturbances are due to phenomena related to solar flares. A big glob of the solar corona comes flying out at enormous velocities, like 1,000 kilometers per second. And solar wind, which is totally ionized, that is, it's a bunch of protons and electrons and some helium, doubly with charged helium and so on. It acts like a a fluid, which was a big surprise to the early people. They couldn't see how it acted like a fluid, but it does. And the reasons are known, but not for this. This big blob, which is called a coronal mass ejection, goes through the solar wind, and like a boat going through an ocean, it causes a shock. And this shock manages to accelerate particles in the solar wind to very high energies. And those particles come into the Earth and can do all sorts of damage to spacecraft, also spacecraft in space. And the whole coronal mass ejections cause great geomagnetic storms, and there are big currents in certain parts of the atmosphere. And those currents cause currents in the flow in the power plants in their, the result of that can be a failure. You know, like if you have a big surge of current on your wire at home, you're liable to blow out the toaster. Well, if you have a big surge of current in the ionosphere, you blow out the power plants. And that's very expensive and very annoying. And so that's one of the things people, if you knew one of these very fast coronal mass ejections was coming, then you could do something to shut down the power plant for a couple of hours and then put it back up again. But so this is of great importance to power plant people and causes lots of money being lost. Yes, right. And so that the expectation, if you got one, that you got several, was high, and that made a difference in the prediction as to what you may get. That is, if we knew there were, in the time it flew, about 10 big events, big coronal mass ejections, it makes a big difference in predicting whether those 10 came in three groups of three and one separate, or which would make you have to predict four groups or 10 separate groups. The statistics are altogether different. And in those models, the models that the spacecraft are designed to, that is to say, I calculate the probability that you couldn't get an event with so and so many high energy particles of such and such a flux of the particles. And then the designers of the spacecraft have to take that information and say, okay, we have to design our spacecraft and the instruments on it so that it can stand that much radiation without collapsing. And that's what the space environment needs. Okay? Nelson? No, what happened was that the model that was invented had an error in it. And I corrected the error, and the error gave different results for the space environment than the original prediction method. And they were important different events. In fact, when Magellan went up, suddenly I got a telephone call from the chief scientist saying, my God, we've had all these sudden events on the sun. Is that going to kill us? I said, no, you designed for it. And he was much relieved. Well, it would be a waste of money because you have to make certain decisions about protecting the spacecraft. And if you make decisions that are way out of reality, you waste money because you spend too much time worrying, too much money protecting it, or waste time because you haven't spent, given it enough protection and it gets clobbered. So it's in spacecraft design and so on, you have to worry about the possibilities that things get broken or that things don't work. And there's money either way, so it's a give and take on that project. Also, well, the human stuff is very important. I mean, if you want to fly to Mars or something, you have to know what the environment is. And if you've got a human being in there, then you have to decide what probability you want that he will not be hurt, he or she will not be hurt by the high energy particles that come. Now, and my job was to predict the probabilities, and there are new models that have been developed since mine, but all the models are based on the same general principles. And one of the problems is that there's a lot of question about the description of, if you make something, if you want to know how many events are going to have fluences or fluxes above a certain amount, it very much depends on, when you do it, it very much depends on what you know about coronal mass ejections. And so, besides doing the space weather part, I also do things like study what you know about coronal mass ejections. And the sun has a solar cycle, which every 11 years the sun gets more spots, and then it starts out for 3 or 4 years with the sun increasing the number of sunspots, and then for 7 years it decreases the number of sunspots. And the number of events that you expect depends partly on the sunspot number. So it would be nice to be able to predict the sunspot number. Now, it takes, say, 10, 15, 20 years to decide you're going to make a spacecraft, to design the spacecraft, to get it all ready, and to launch it, okay? So you have to know what the sunspot cycle is going to be like 20, 30 years from now. And we don't know how to do that. And we don't know how to make those predictions because we don't understand the solar dynamo, which is the dynamo is the motions which cause the sun to have the magnetic field that it does and the sunspots that it does. And so one of the things I do is study the solar cycle and the solar dynamo. And during the last 10 years, the sun has been doing something very unexpected. That is to say, it has been much, much calmer than was generally expected. In my opinion, that's because there's another cycle of the amplitude of the sunspot cycle, which is about 90 to 100 years. And so what I'm doing at the moment is seriously looking into that, finding whatever I can find out about this 80 to 90 to 100 year cycle, which I call the Centennial Glasberg cycle, and what's its cause on the sun, and what's its effect on Earth. Now, there's a lot of evidence that during periods at the minimum of these 88 or 100 year cycle, Centennial Glasberg cycle, there's a cooling effect. The sun's ultraviolet radiation is apparently, we don't really know, but there's some evidence that it changes. It interacts with the Earth's atmosphere. This is not agreed to by everybody, but there's evidence for it. That the changes in the solar output interact with the Earth's atmosphere to change the climate, so that when the sun is at the minimum of the Centennial Glasberg cycle, it's a little cooler on Earth than it would otherwise be. So my guess, and at this point only a guess, is that one reason that the Earth isn't hotter than it is because the sun has been cooling it relatively. That is, the heating from the sun has been relatively small, 27 to 10. And but I don't know how much smaller, and I don't even know if that's true. But you ask me what I'm working on now, and I'm working to find out if that's true. So it's my present. If it is true, it would mean that the warming due to the carbon dioxide, which I think people now believe in, since it's true, and we've known it's true for 15 years or so. But anyway, it would mean that the cooling from the carbon dioxide is partially canceled by this. I mean, the heating from the carbon dioxide is partially canceled by the cooling from the sun, so that we are probably underestimating the cooling that we'll have in 15 years if you just say, okay, it's going to continue whatever it's doing now. So it's important, I think, that the most important problem in the Earth, for all societies in the world today, is the fact that we are paying no attention, essentially no attention, to the global warming, which is going to clobber us. The impact that the sun is having is minor, but it is in the direction of currently making the carbon dioxide hot, warming, or look smaller. If you think it's all due to carbon dioxide, then you think that the warming of the Earth is less important than it really is. But the effect of the sun on the Earth in this Centennial Glasberg cycle is still not agreed to by everyone. And of course, if you're asking me what I'm working on, I've got to be working on something that's not agreed to by everybody. If it's agreed to, you don't work on it anymore if you're a scientist. Well, look there. Science is a wonderful thing, because when we know something, one of the side effects is that we realize there's something else we don't understand. And then you go on from there. So there are always new subjects in science. And for young people, it's a good idea to work, if they're interested, on the subject that they find interesting or delightful, and that's new, because it's easier when it's new. What happens is all the easy things get done at the beginning, and then it gets harder and harder to make new contributions, and they're less and less important. So rather than looking at what's, you know, a 15-year-old kid, boy or girl, who looks and sees what's interesting now, may find that by the time they're ready to get their PhD, something else is more exciting. And that's where they ought to be studying. But you've got to study something that really excites you. Otherwise, you know, it's a matter of personality, what you like to do. But science is something you have to do because you like to do it. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Scientists are supposed to be so dispassionate people. We're not at all. We're very passionate people. We spend long hours working on things. We're only paid for part of the time, more or less. I mean, you don't leave the problem when you come home from work. You work on it in your sleep. It's not a job like selling shoes. Well, you may want to forget about it when you come home and think of something else. It's a passion. And if you're not passionate about it, you shouldn't try it because it's very it's difficult. You have to do a lot of learning and a lot of thinking. And if you don't have a passion for it, you're not gonna enjoy it. There's no point in going into it if you're not passionate about it. The reason I was interested in all of this was because all of this geomagnetic activity and the solar influence on the Earth, one of the things that it produces is aurora, which are very beautiful. And when I was a kid, not a terrible lot was known about them, except that they came from the sun caused them. And when I was about 4 years old, my brother got permission from my mom. It was nighttime and I was in bed asleep. My brother got permission from my mom to wake me up and take me to see the aurora, which was happening on Long Island at that time. And he walked me to nearby golf course, and I looked up and there were lights, which I remember as green, though they may not have been green. But there were lights flashing in the sky, and it was very beautiful, and I got hooked. So that's what I've been studying the rest of my life. All of my family was very interested in science, my father and my brother. My mother was interested in the beauty of nature. But, you know, there I was, a little kid, and my brother got permission to break all of the rules so that he could show me the aurora. So my mother and father were behind this also. So it was very exciting for a little kid. So it's been great fun for my life. And I started at a time when it was not considered reasonable for women to do this. But now it is. And so I think, you know, anybody who finds something in science or somewhere else that enthralls them to do it. I was told it was impossible. It turned out that was wrong.
I hope you enjoyed the Space Weather Living History podcast brought to you by NASA's Sun Earth Days program. You can learn more about the Space Weather Living History Project on our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. And don't forget to join our growing community of Facebook and Twitter fans for the latest information and facts about the new Sun Earth Day themes. For all other details about these programs, including information about our past Sun Earth Days themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov.
This is Troy Klein signing off.